And I'm Mary Angish. Hi, Charlie Nardozzi.
Hi, Mary Angish.
You've got a particular flowering shrub to share more about that we're seeing it blooming right now. It's in the hibiscus family. What can you tell us about the Rose of Sharon?
Yes, it's kind of an odd name because this shrub is not in the rose family and it's not from Sharon. It's actually from India and China. And the Rose of Sharon, like you said, it's in the hibiscus family related to the hardy hibiscus and the tropical, subtropical hibiscus. Beautiful shrub that will get up anywhere from 10 to 13 feet tall on a lot of them. But there are some varieties that will actually stay a little shorter. So the chiffon series is the one that a lot of people know about. They're white or red or pink or blue colored flowers on them. Beautiful hibiscus shaped flowers that are edible, by the way, too. Make a nice little snack. And that one will get really big. But if you're looking for a dwarf one, Little Kim is a nice one. If you're looking for a variegated one, Sugar Tip is good. And there's even one that grows like a pillar, grows up tall and narrow like Purple Pillar. These all are beautiful plants to put in the landscape because they're flowering now when not a lot of other things are flowering. The place to plant them is in full sun, on well-drained soil. Give them their own spot on the lawn or in a garden. Just give them some room. Make sure you know how big they are. And there's really not a lot of problems with them. Japanese beetles will go after them, but we can control those. And some of the older varieties do self-sow. That is an issue, especially in the Southeast, where it can become a little invasive. So if you want to avoid any self-sowing, just make sure you deadhead all the flowers when they're done. Or grow varieties that are hybrids, like the double varieties or the Sugar Tip or Minerva varieties. Those have sterile seed, so they will not self-sow. Otherwise, this is a really nice shrub to have in your landscape, especially this time of year.
Question time. This one's coming in from Lee in Richmond, and Lee has been noticing a couple of different things happening in her garden. She writes, I've been watching and picking off tomato plant stems that were getting spotted in yellow and withered, and I assumed that it was rainy weather or oversaturated soil. But Lee writes, I watched a male cardinal rummaging around in the tomato plants and went out to see what he was up to, discovered my first tomato hornworm was there. And Lee writes that they removed the tomato hornworm, put it in a soapy bunch of water, but is wondering now, does the cardinal eat the hornworms and should they just maybe leave them there?
Well, I'm not sure if cardinals are going to eat hornworms. Hornworms are pretty big. That's a big feast for a cardinal. I think, regardless, you should go ahead and keep pulling them off. There's plenty of things to eat out there for the birds, and they'll probably get the tomato hornworms, if they like them, that you can't find. So go ahead, pick them off, put them in the soapy water.
This next one's coming in from Tom in Georgia, and Tom had some questions. He'd recently heard you talking about Japanese beetle traps in a previous episode and did some research and is seeing that people should not be using Japanese beetle traps. Can you kind of tell us more about that?
Well, Tom, yeah, thank you for looking into that and thank you for alerting me because, yes, you're right. Japanese beetle traps now, when I was looking at different extension sites and different university sites, you know, non-partial sites, none of them really recommend them anymore because the evidence that they have is that they bring in more Japanese beetles than they actually trap. There were a few sites that still said if you're going to use them, keep them a couple hundred feet away from your garden. So that is something to think about when you're trapping for Japanese beetles or thinking about trapping for Japanese beetles next year. You might want to use some other methods like beneficial nematodes this fall or just simply doing some more hand picking. So thank you, Tom, for keeping me on my toes.
And this next issue is coming from a couple of people, one of them Jane Lindholm here at Vermont Public, as well as Christina in Burlington, who wrote in to say, my lilacs appear to have a significant case of blight. Is it worth heavily pruning them and hoping they'll return next year, or should I get rid of them completely?
No, don't get rid of your lilacs, Jane or Christina. There's two different diseases that are really plaguing lilacs this year because of the wet weather we've had. One is powdery mildew, and that's when the lilac leaf yellows a little bit and curls more than turns white. And that one is just ubiquitous in the environment. I wouldn't worry about that because it's going to be here regardless every year, sometimes worse when it's wet weather. The other is a blight, like you were mentioning. That's a bacterial disease that actually scorches the leaves. It looks like they've been hit by a torch and they're browned. That one is a little more contagious and a little more of a concern, so I would clean up the leaves afterwards as much as you can and remove them from the environment. Again, though, if we have a dry spring and summer next year, it won't be an issue. If it's wet, you might have to spray with some kind of organic spray to knock it down before it gets going.
And send questions if you have them to gardening@vermontpublic.org. Thanks, Charlie.
You're welcome, Mary, and I'll be seeing you in the garden.